We are talking markets again, and my guest today is Dr. Adrian Saville. He's, of course, a self-proclaimed disciple of contrarian deep value investing. He's also the chief strategist at Citadel and the chief investment officer at Cannon Asset Managers. Adrian, welcome to the show. We are currently still in choppy waters following Britain's decision to exit the EU, and there's significant uncertainty and volatility in virtually every single investment market around the world. How do you read this current market environment?
There's a number of surprises in the recent past, and perhaps a couple of them to build on your observations. Is the first was that Britain voted to exit. The bookies got it wrong. The banks got it wrong. The bond market got it wrong. And to add another B to that, perhaps Britain got it wrong. But be that as it may, a huge surprise doesn't do justice, shock in the currency market. Capital markets also responded with shock. And to everyone's amazement, the Rand in the last couple of weeks has been one of the strongest performing currencies. So to make sense of this, I'm not quite sure how you get all the different moving parts into a sort of a coherent storyboard, other than to remind us that markets are filled with surprise, and that perhaps the best philosophical architecture we can put around this is to be reminded not to invest for certainty or to invest based on forecasts, but to start your investment process based on uncertainty and unknowability. And right now that uncertainty and unknowability is elevated. So I think that's how you make sense of it, and that's how you manage it.
But Adrian, you know, you look at this environment and, you know, it seems like the traditional valuation methods of earnings potential is taking a back seat. You know, how difficult is it to invest in this market at the moment?
Greg, I think the earnings potential has been compromised in some places, and it's been enhanced in others. The rule remains that, you know, when you're making investments, when you're buying assets, what we're always after is, you know, strong, robust, sustainable earnings potential. And there've been some real surprises, as your observation suggests. So for instance, the gold miners have benefited tremendously from, the uncertain environment, which has seen the gold price marked up impressively, and a business like Pan Africa that we've been invested in for a number of years starts the year at 2 Rand, and as we speak it's at 4 Rand 50, so that's a 100% return in less than a year, or in the space of 6 months. At the same time, there are others that have been hurt. Look up in UK property as having been hurt by the uncertainty. So I think investing is about equipping yourself for this certainty, never losing sight of the fact that it is earnings that matter, and always owning portfolios rather than single assets. So if you actually owned a portfolio of Pan Africa and British property, you'd be okay this year.
Well, if you look at the JSE, the All Share has been relatively stable the last 12 months. But if you strip out Naspers and SAB Miller, the index is actually down significantly. You've got counters like Standard Bank down 24% from recent highs, Sanlam down 20%, Bright down 20%. You are a value investor. Are you starting to see value in some clusters in the market here?
Yeah, I think, you know, first, just before commenting on your question, is to recognize that investing is as much about what you own as what you don't own. It's always about the allocation of scarce capital. And if you'd owned the index, you would have done well. If you'd owned Naspers and SAB, you would have done well. But if you owned the index less those two, it's been a tough environment. And the tough environment then reflects those falling prices. And falling prices, as long as businesses haven't been compromised, then you're getting the same asset, or, you know, an equivalent asset for a better price. And I think that's exactly what successful investing is about. So in this market environment, you know, there's some parts that I'm still fairly anxious about. I think the banks are an interesting point of departure, because although their models are under pressure and the weak economy means that the business foundations aren't as strong as the banks would like, the large banks are well diversified. They've got well-managed books, good risk systems. The economy is anemic, but it hasn't collapsed. There's still evidence of, you know, some consumer buoyancy. There's a bit of manufacturing sector resilience. So the banks might be a place to go to find supported, if not strong, but supported business models. And some of the valuations on those banks are really interesting. I have to wonder, you know, if in a few years' time you won't look back and think, wow, you know, there was a great opportunity to get a bank on a very elevated dividend yield, a single-digit price earnings multiple, trading at book value or just above. Investec, Nedbank are good cases in point.
Are you buying banks at the moment?
We are, and alongside banks, another place where we found some interesting opportunity is in the South African-facing businesses. An example, which is owned in some of our portfolios, is Group 5. And Group 5, you know, when I mentioned the name, investors familiar with the South African market will immediately hear reference to a South African business. However, Group 5 over the years has built a very viable asset outside of South Africa, and that's their European concessions business, where they run road infrastructure. You know, you can think of e-toll type infrastructure. And not only is this a very powerful business in terms of stable revenue, the margins are good, the cash flow is great, and we've recently worked on valuing that side of the business. My colleague Andrew Ditburner did this work, and the net present value of that concessions business is essentially equivalent to Group 5's market cap once you adjust for cash. And Group 5 is sitting with just over $1.5 billion cash on balance sheet, which means you can net that off against the market cap and the debt. And here's a case of almost being paid to buy the business. And, you know, it's those types of examples that I think you have to look for in this environment, but they are without question available.
Adrian, contrarian investors have not performed all that well in recent years. Do you think the current environment is maybe more suitable for such an approach as part of a diversified portfolio than, say, a year or two ago?
Without question, if you've got the stomach to tolerate volatility, and if you've got a long investment runway, in other words, if you've got the time to tolerate the volatility, so you need both time and stomach, then there is this type of environment, I think, really feeds a contrarian strategy. However, I suppose as you suggest or hint, this is not for everyone. I certainly believe it has a place in portfolios, and here I can walk my talk, because two of my favorite clients are my son and my daughter, who are 13 years old and 10 years old. They don't interrogate performance. They don't mind volatility. They're very patient. and they've got 30 or 40 years of compounding ahead of them. And it's contrarian positions and deep value positions that play best into that type of investment appetite. But if you are, you know, closer to retirement, or if you have an income need, or if this is capital that has to support a fairly near-term obligation, then no, you know, you don't want a deep value portfolio. You would want something that's far more stable, and probably stabilized not by being in 100% equities, but by having multi-asset, some bonds, some preference shares, some cash. Depending on your appetite or tolerance for volatility, and depending on your horizon and the need.
Adrian, your funds have performed relatively well in recent times, but many investors in contrarian funds have disinvested because of poor performance. You say investors should be patient, but how long should an investor be patient when his or her investments are not performing?
If a philosophy is sound and if there's a robust process behind that philosophy, then my guidance to every investor, every capital allocator, would be to find a philosophy that you understand, that you agree in, to find that you believe in and agree with, to find a process that's repeatable, and then to stay with it. There is no such thing as a monopoly on alpha. There is no such thing as a monopoly on outperformance. No one has perfected the challenge of uninterrupted performance. And if you are going to beat the market, then it's a mathematical given that there are times that you'll have to look different to the market, and that differentness will be underperformance as well as outperformance. The portfolios that I look after for Citadel recognize this and recognize the very modest appetite for deviance from benchmark, whereas a Canon portfolio is comfortable looking very different to the market. And that has translated into patches of spectacular outperformance, and in recent times, much tougher. And the business has lost mandates where investors have just got frustrated. They don't want to walk through the difficult patch. But for those who have stayed with us, I think the rewards more than justify the patience, but it does require patience and it does require a stomach for volatility. It's impossible to say when the cycle will turn and when you'll find a fierce recovery and appetite for value or deep value. But when revulsion is the deepest, that's when the opportunity is greatest.
Yeah.
And, I think that being able to buy special positions or specific positions is exactly what this environment throws up. It sets me up to be wrong if I say I can't think of a better time to go for this type of mandate, but this is a good time. When revulsion is high, when price dislocations are large, and when money is not searching for these opportunities, that's when they're often the best.
Your Superdogs portfolio is a very interesting one, and it plays into what you've just referred to. But why is it not a unit trust? Why can't retail investors, invest in it like a normal unit trust?
Superdogs, it's a gorgeous portfolio. I've been running it for a number of years. It is the type of portfolio that you make reference to where you say, is there a place for an out of favor or deep value type strategy? I think this is the type of a piece that fits that part of the jigsaw puzzle. We haven't unitized it historically. That was really just a sort of a business decision rather than a decision around making the portfolio available to investors. And for investors with 200,000 Rand or more and a five-year horizon, then this is the place that they can access a contrarian or deep value strategy. And it's not that they would be locked in for 5 years. It's just that they are sheltered from tax obligations if they stay with the investment for 5 years. They treat it as an investor, and they get the benefits of institutional pricing, institutional trading, and the benefit also of being in a pool. And we put the investment hurdle at 200,000, really just to I suppose protect ourselves more than anything from investors who, one moment said, well, here's 10,000 Rand, and then the next said, I don't like it, I've gone away. So I don't know if 200,000 is the right number, but we put the figure high enough that anyone who put money in would have thought hard about the decision. And so far, that seems to have worked. We've had very few redemptions in in a number of years that we've been running the portfolio, that investors who've come in have stayed in, and they're getting nice results. Over the last 3 years, that Superdog's portfolio is ahead of market by a comfortable margin.
Well, it's done phenomenally well since 2009 when it was launched. Annual return of around, say, 27%, which is definitely not pedestrian. But Adrian, let's quickly talk about the underlying assets within that portfolio. I've got the fact sheet here until the end of March, and it lists Pinnacle Holdings, Ascendus Health, Conduit Capital, Transaction Capital, and Sabvest as the five biggest holdings. Is that still the case? And can you quickly just say why those companies appeal to you?
Sure, Ray. The holdings don't change, or when they do change, it's on an annual review. So what you see there as the top holdings would remain the case. Of course, price action moves the weights around. But we build the portfolio at the start of each year, buying an equal weighted position in the most unloved but profitable companies on the JSE. And we hold that position for 12 months. So price action will move the weights around. And so it's really just a statistical anomaly what you see as the largest weights there. The thinking in the names that you mentioned, and there's others that we could go to, is each of those businesses that you make reference to is an established business. It's profitable. The portfolio, the assets that sit behind those investments in the portfolio are good assets. So there's no element of this that, you know, I would describe as speculative. The fact that they're profit making means that we're buying businesses that are unloved, but by no means distressed. And, the bulk of them are dividend paying. So here you've got, a portfolio of established, profitable businesses that are dividend paying, and you can acquire them on very low multiples. When we formed the portfolio at the beginning of the year, the market was trading on a 20 PE. We paid an average 9x price earnings ratio. In other words, we paid half the market multiple to form this portfolio. And if investing is about buying good assets at good prices, then I think that this captures that essence.
How many stocks are there in the portfolio?
That's an important point because it is going into the part of the market that's unloved. We've been very deliberate in making sure that we've mitigated specific risk. You know, specific risk refers to the threat that that a business in which you're invested blows up and you lose all of your money. So there's just over 40 names in the portfolio, which means the average weighting is, you know, around 2%. And that specific risk is extremely low then. Since the portfolio was formed, we haven't had such an event. We've been able to successfully manage quality so that whilst I do make reference to buying quality or good businesses or established businesses on good prices, a third component is that in every instance, we've assessed the businesses for balance sheet strength, the sustainability of profitability, that there is established management teams in place and so on. In other words, there is a veiled quality element. But the 40 stocks, in a sentence, mitigate specific risk.
Just lastly, I read some interesting statistics about the foreigners investing in South Africa. Before June, we saw an outflow of quite a few billion rand. But since the week of Brexit, actually, we've seen a lot of inflows from foreign investors. Actually, on the day of the Brexit vote, 4.2 billion rand came into South Africa. And for the 2 weeks prior to that, we saw 14 billion rand coming into South Africa. A lot of consecutive trading days, net inflows. Are you watching what the foreigners are doing, what they are buying, and what is the impact of their investment choices on the asset prices here?
My colleague George Herman shared with me some data which points to, I think we're on something like day 25 of ongoing inflows. And that really is a remarkable turn in appetite. If you think December last year, the money was rushing out the door.
Yes.
And for the last month, it's done the exact opposite. It does highlight the vulnerability or fragility of South Africa to capital flows, and it also highlights the fickleness of capital, how quickly it can change its mind. These flows certainly matter to South Africa. Although we are a sophisticated and established market, the flows have a large swing influence on prices, and they go a long way in explaining the remarkable strength of the rand since Brexit, which has gone from high 15s to the dollar to early 14s to the dollar in just a few weeks. The impact goes beyond rand, as you suggest, and that's to equity markets. Of course, that foreign capital won't be going for the mid and small equity that, you know, we were chatting about now, that mainly populates my Superdog's portfolio. Instead, it's going to be going for the large cap businesses, the large industrials, the large miners, and the banks, which we mentioned briefly.
Adrian, U.S. markets are close to an all-time high virtually on a daily basis now. In Europe, there's a lot of uncertainty and volatility. We don't know what's going to happen in the East. What should investors do? Should they be cautious? Should they see investment opportunities? Or should they be nervous?
I think investors should always be nervous. In any environment, you can think of good reasons not to invest. And I think that, you know, that nervousness, I probably want to change the word nervous to cautious or suspicious or cynical. You want to invest always with your eyes wide open. You want to invest with the knowledge that things jump out of cupboards on Thursday afternoons without warning, markets are filled with as much unknowability as they are filled with uncertainty or risk. In the current environment, I suppose the things that worry me most and the rest of my team is the very elevated prices on some asset classes. The government bonds in advanced countries are a very obvious case in point. In equities, you've got the S&P 500 reaching record highs right now, yet earnings year on year are falling. And economic growth looks like it's going to be taken lower by Brexit rather than higher. That's bad for Europe, and it's bad for Britain. So I think there's lots of reasons to be nervous in the current environment. To trot out the old analogy, investing though is not—it's not a sprint; it's a marathon. And if you're disciplined about buying good assets at good prices, you'll be rewarded.
Thank you, Adrian. That was Dr. Adrian Saville. He's the Chief Strategist at Citadel and the Chief Investment Officer at Cannon Asset Managers.